guess the alternative and shorter title would have been How I Spent My Summer Vacation. A little less informative, though. I don't know about you guys, but I took this picture, or sorry, I pulled this picture off the campus website last week, and I don't know about you guys, but it makes me want to go to a beach right now instead of go back to snow. All right, before I can begin about some of my research or work that I've done with sexual and apomictic bokra, I wanted to briefly describe the bigger picture that we're doing over in our lab, which is apomixis. And for those of you not familiar with apomixis, it's basically put asexual reproduction through seeds, though various forms of this kind of asexual reproduction or parthenogenesis is found across multiple eukaryotic kingdoms and in diverse mannerisms. As you can see on the right side, there's a few examples of the different methods of apomixis and parthenogenesis. Because of this, largely the genetic control of apomixis is not very well known and hasn't been very well documented. But the multi-million dollar answer to the question of why study apomixis then is that it could easily revolutionize industrial agriculture. What comes to mind for me quickly is spontaneous production of embryos in something like corn would allow the fixation of hybrid vigor from generation to generation. Instead of crossing inbreds to create hybrids and hybrid seed production every year, one can simply just propagate the hybrid itself, retaining the heterosis. So this could be groundbreaking stuff if we manage to ever figure out the genetic control behind it and transform it into commercial crops. Why bokra? Bokra is a little mustard seed plant. It's not particularly interesting or useful to cash crops or agriculture, but it does contain closely related species within the genus that are both sexual and apomictic, so it makes for ideal genetic expression comparison studies. The embryology of apomixis is well studied in bokra, along with the wealth of information that comes with being closely related to Rhabdopsis. Now, the materials I used for this work, we had 20 microarrays, but what was interesting about what we did is we had 20 Arabidopsis microarrays. So what we've done here is we've done what they call cross-species hybridization microarrays. In other words, we applied bokra RNA to Arabidopsis-designed arrays. And I'll get to in a minute why this works, but we broke our treatment groups into reproductive types, which is with one sexual species and two apomictic species, harvesting from many, many ovules, which I'm glad I didn't have to do that by hand, and divided it by four stages of embryo development. Quick review on the ATH1 array, which is the Arabidopsis Affymetrix gene chip array. I'm sure most of you are familiar with how microarray technology works, but a key point I wanted to point out here is the 22 probes per gene over 500,000 locations on the array is what the chip uses to detect gene expression. So there's redundant copies of the probes all over the chip, and depending on the relative hybridization of your sample is how it determines the expression level. Now, what we did, which wasn't exactly unique, this has been done in other places, but what they call cross-species arrays, like I was saying, is we have a non-model organism applying to a model organism array. And this has been done in various different locations with different species on different model chips, such as multiple plants on Arabidopsis or different organisms on human arrays and so on. And well, I had to do the plug for the goat and the cow array. But in order to do successful cross-species analyses, you have to modify the microarray procedure slightly. What we did was a data filtration approach, which the people out in Nottingham called GDNA-based probe masking. And what that is the Nottingham Arabidopsis Stock Center, they'll take a genomic DNA sample from your target species and apply just the diced-up genomic DNA onto your, for instance, in this case, the Arabidopsis array. And this particular array is used to calibrate or to filter probes that did not successfully hybridize to your array. So rather than testing for gene expression here, you're just testing for homology. By using the subsequent file that's created from this particular gDNA array, we're able to see and determine which probes did not hybridize well based on the fact of homology and not on the fact of just not being expressed. And this creates what they call a chip description file, which is what the computer uses to interpret the microarray data files. Now to oversimplify this, how this works in limiting all cumbersome statistics, basically how masking works in theory is that, let's take for instance, we have a gene here, and it has seven probes that all bind and relate to this one particular gene. Now in this simplified case here, we have seven probes, two of which bound successfully to the microarray, but five on the other hand did not bind due to homology reasons. Now when the computer summarizes these probe intensities into a gene expression, this may not represent what the true gene's expression was due to the fact of these mishybridizations of these weaker probes. Now masking, what it does is it allows you to set a user-defined threshold to cut off all probes that don't hybridize well enough to be included into the study. So for example, in this example again, but with masking, let's say I set an intensity threshold of 100, thus cutting off all of these five bad hybridizing probes, leaving only the two good ones, giving us a very different number for gene expression. And this is, like I said, just an example, but this could mean the difference between being called as present or significant. This is done in a script called XSpecies, which comes from the Nottingham Arabidopsis Stock Center. This is what creates your filtering process. The analyses were all done in R and Bioconductor. A little plug for freeware. And differential expression analyses were done using more than one method, using two different models, I should say, both a permutation and a linear model to help confirm results. One key point of the masking process is the threshold selection, which is why I included this slide here. As you can see, we got two lines for these two different apomictic species. The top line is the number of sets retained, and you can think of a probe set as being the collection of probes that define one gene. So this would be like over 22,000 probe sets. I don't know if you can see that, but over 22,000 probe sets coding for 22,000 genes on the Arabidopsis array. This bottom line is the total number of probes. So the idea is to maximize the retention of probe sets, which is gene coverage, while also maximizing the elimination of poor hybridizing probes. And as you can see here, these are the actual thresholds we selected for these two different species, and they were relatively high, retaining many of the probe sets. And our results were very encouraging. As you can see in this graph, or this column here, that we retained greater than 99% of all probe sets. So by eliminating, in some cases, up to 55% of the probes, we still retained 99% of the genes. And we were very encouraged by the results we saw, as there was, in one case, up to a 5 times increase in the number of differentially expressed genes, or significant genes that we found. And on average, it increased by about 50%. We also looked at Go enrichment. A gene ontology, or Go, is an annotation of for instance, like a function of a gene, therefore allowing you to categorize your genes by what they do, for instance. And we enriched these. And what a Go enrichment test is, similar to a global test, in that if a Go category has been enriched, that's saying that a group of genes as a group was found to be more significant than expected. So in particular, these Go categories here were found to be enriched, or rather, they were more, even though these are all significant genes, this particular category was found to be even more significant, which begins to paint a very interesting picture that we're looking at right now of what could be controlling the apomixis phenotype, which obviously we don't believe is a single trait controlling it, but we're starting to find out that There could be a number of related factors that are all involved in controlling apomixis. And lastly, we did do quantitative real-time PCR to confirm and validate our array expression levels, and we found similar to nearly identical expression levels from our PCR as to our masked arrays. And in conclusion, pushing the gDNA-based masking approach allowed us to successfully do a cross-hybridization of our arrays. So we were able to use our BOCRA and do successful gene detection on an Arabidopsis array and increase the number of differentially expressed genes that we found their fold changes and including and improving the enrichment of our GO categories. And these and other results have been used to that we're studying further candidate, I guess, groups of candidate genes for the apomixis phenotype. And some acknowledgments, I guess. That's it.